Hello, everyone, and happy August. How is it already August? This is the question that I'm just running through my head nonstop, but here we are, your August episode of the ACO Pedescast podcast series, the official podcast of the ACOP. And as always, I am joined with my esteemed co-host, Scott Cyrus. Scott, how are you doing today?
Oh, we are just doing fantastic. We've got a real special treat for everybody today. Just a special find. So I'm eager to get into this talk.
Yes, and I know we both have some scheduling, so Scott and I are going to do our best to stay on task today. But we'll start with introducing our special guest. Dr. Mary Dubon is a physician scientist at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, which is part of Northwestern in Chicago. She is trained in physical medicine and rehab with her initial training and then with, I think I got these written down right, with two fellowships, one in pediatric rehab science and one in pediatric sports medicine, being only the second person in the country to have both of these. We are so lucky to have her as our guest today. Without further ado, welcome Dr. Dubon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, this has been, we are very excited because as you know, August, we are still in the summer, but we are returning to school. We are turning to school sports. We are, you know, and with that becomes a lot of risks and a lot of counseling that we need to do as our students prepare to beat the summer heat, and some of them doing it with multiple pounds of padding on, as I remember from my good old high school football days. And so we thought this would be a great time to have on someone with your expertise to talk about things like sports injuries, how to stay safe, and what to do if you do have an injury. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So Mary, we were talking before we, you know, hit the record button.
And
with your fellowship in both, physical medicine, pediatric physical medicine, as well as sports medicine, give us a background on the similarities and the differences between those two fellowships.
Absolutely. So physical medicine and rehabilitation actually started as two different specialties at the same time they were being created. And one was really focused on disability and all of the medical and psychosocial aspects of disability. So if someone has an amputation, you know, you can think about their rehab, but you could also think about the fact that they might have skin concerns with their prosthetic and making sure that their prosthetic is fitting in a way that's not going to cause wounds. And also thinking about the psychosocial impact of, you know, maybe a new onset disability. A lot of it was surrounding people in the military who were injured and trying to rehab. The other side of it was really more the physical medicine side of things, about how to physically help someone's healing, and not as much focused on the medical complications or psychosocial complications. And as the two, you know, fields were being developed, they realized that there was a bit of overlap between the two. And that's how it became one specialty called physical medicine and rehabilitation. We have so many names for our field. So physiatry, some people in the country say physiatry or physiatry. Are you a rehab doctor? Are you a PM&R doctor? We get PMNR, which is not accurate, but sometimes it gets confusing because people don't know it's a N sign and not an N. And so we're a confusing field, but because of that, a lot of people that go into it are either kind of leaning towards the rehab side, where, like, you know, disability care and looking at disability holistically and making sure you're improving someone's quality of life and taking care of their medical complications, but also knowing how to, you know, prescribe the right type of rehab for them. There's a lot of us that are focused on that area, but then there's also people who are really interested in the physical healing aspect, and that's more towards the modern sports medicine. And so within the field of PM&R, when you're doing the residency, you learn both. But I would say most people enter with a kind of leaning towards one versus the other. So I'm a little bit unique in that I did pediatric fellowships in both pediatric rehab medicine and pediatric sports medicine, because typically, like I said, people lean one way or the other. So that's kind of the difference. So in my pediatric rehab medicine fellowship, I learned about the medical complications and how to take care of it for cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, amputation, stroke, lots of things on that list. Whereas in my pediatric sports medicine fellowship, I was learning about taking care of acute and overuse injuries in sports medicine. And one of the main reasons that I did both was because I realized that kids with disabilities can play sports, and there wasn't a whole lot in the literature and known clinically for clinical practice guidelines, or I always say, you know, just even community guidelines, like Little League rules we have for kids without disabilities. But what about those kids with disabilities who, you know, are using their arms to get around with their wheelchair, and they're also using it for wheelchair sports? So I think that's kind of the distinction and a little bit of background. I also wanted to put a plug, because I know the audience here is pediatrics. Mm-hmm. There is not currently a way to go from pediatrics to pediatric rehab medicine. However, I was part of the task force to put a proposal in so that hopefully that is going to be a pathway in the future. So just in case folks are interested, because I've heard from so many people who are pediatrics trained that they love taking care of pediatric disability. They wish they knew that this was a specialty when they were in med school deciding. But now that they did pediatrics, they don't want to go back and do a second residency, which is how you do it if you've completed your pediatrics residency. But now, hopefully, within the next handful of years, there will be an option that you can, you can actually do some sort of training to become boarded in pediatric rehab medicine from a pediatric standpoint. That was a long answer to your short question, but there it is.
No, that's great. That's awesome. No, because like I said, I was, when you said you were board certified in both, it was like, oh, okay. Where do they cross and where do they separate kind of thing? And that was really great. Cause I was thinking about, when you were talking about sports medicine and physical medicine, Special Olympics popped in my mind. You know, when you think about all the children that are involved in Special Olympics and all the children that typical pediatrician that doesn't have a pediatric, you know, sports medicine or physical medicine physician, what are they going to be facing out there to maybe one say it's okay for them to participate in Special Olympics or, like you said, Special Little League or something along the line, soccer or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have worked with Special Olympics as well. I was fortunate enough to do a couple things with them. And I actually was at a national, I was working with the medical director of Special Olympics, and he came to me and he was like, all right, you're pediatric sports medicine. I need to tell you something and I need you to help me. And I was fortunately able to help him, but basically there's the pre-participation physical form that we all know that several societies, including American Academy, okay, this is going to get chopped or whatever, AAP. Yeah. So we also know that the AAP and several of the sports and ortho societies and family medicine have come together to create the pre-participation physical template that you use. Well, that template is different than the one that Special Olympics uses. And so they were running into a big issue in Special Olympics where those forms were being filled out by the primary care physician, and then unfortunately, Special Olympics didn't accept those and wanted their form to be filled out. So I was able to kind of help make connections to one of the main authors on the PPE. I found him at a meeting and I was like, Special Olympics had asked about this. And he was great. We were able to get it. So now on the AAP website, if you scroll down on the PPE page, there's actually a link to the Special Olympics PPE form. So just so people know, if you're filling out a form for a Special Olympics athlete, it is different. They're, it's a lot of the same information, but they have some specific information that Special Olympics is requiring. There was a lot of controversy actually in the past with the difference in policies, where Special Olympics was requiring different things for screening for atlantoaxial instability. So that instability of C1 on C2 that can happen in Down syndrome and some other chronic medical conditions. And the literature on it at first was unclear, and then there got to be more clarity. And actually, the policy is now the same for American Academy of Pediatrics, all the sports medicine societies, and Special Olympics, which is wonderful. But that was one of the reasons why the forms were originally different. But now they still are different, but the policy is still the same, that you're going to be screening for any signs or symptoms before you're going to do an x-ray, because the x-rays can easily be, and they can be interpreted in different ways. And I think in the past, with just asymptomatic screening with the x-rays themselves, the concern was that we were keeping kids out of sport that we didn't need to be kept out of sport. So in terms of injuries for the Special Olympic population, I did a scoping review a couple of years ago with some colleagues, looking at what's in the literature. And there's a handful of studies that are out there, but it doesn't give us a whole lot of details. So as far as we know, there is a big question mark in terms of what injuries might be different. And that's in part because the way that the data was collected. So, you know, Special Olympics is depending on volunteers to be doing their screenings. And so a lot of the, you know, came to the first aid station for XYZ, it's coded very generically. So it'll be like knee pain or knee injury. And it's not necessarily like you're going to have an MRI that's going to give you the results of what it is, right? It's not like the Olympics or Paralympics data that's very robust because they have all those resources to report that. So, you know, we weren't able to do it as a full, like, you know, systematic review meta-analysis, but we did a scoping review. And you know, if anyone's interested in looking at it, there definitely is a need for more data there. But you're going to want to think about all the same things you're thinking about for any other athlete, but also think about these athletes might be on medications or might have medical conditions that might make them a little bit more sensitive to the heat or the cold. They might need reminders for, you know, the environmental safety things like sunscreen too, and hydration. And, you know, if you're not, if it's a really hot day and you're not playing, maybe find yourself the tent or a cool place for that too. And then thinking about seizures, I think, you know, just making sure whatever kind of medical safety plans that need to be there, right? We think about asthma safety plans. When I think about athletes with physical disabilities, I think about safety plans for autonomic dysreflexia, which is an emergency in spinal cord injury that can happen. Where the sympathetic nervous system is a little unchecked because of the block along the sympathetic chain in the spinal cord. So blood pressure can go really high with a noxious stimulus below the level of injury. But typically, if an athlete has that risk, they should have some sort of safety plan. And so working with, this is something as a rehab doctor I work on. So working with your experts, I don't ever expect a general pediatrician to know how to develop those plans. And I admire people who do general pediatrics so much because there's so much to be thinking about. I always, when I'm teaching in med schools and such, I always say, just look up the condition that the person might have and then see what specialists you might want to pull in as you're thinking about what kind of safety plans need to be there. For pre-participation screenings, I did the training. I was the clinical director for MedFest, which is the pre-participation group screening for Special Olympics, starting in 2020. So it was really bad timing to be in charge of group screening. So unfortunately, we never wound up actually having a screen, but I did all the training for it. And we switched to just doing some webinars for education for the athletes instead. What I did learn through that is that those screenings are going to have a higher percentage of athletes that are going to not get cleared that day. And that's okay. So if I'm not mistaken, it's something like 30% of them may not be cleared on that day. And that's because, okay, there might be cardiac associated with your condition and I don't have enough records right now to know. Or, you know, you have seizures and we got to check with your neurologist to see what the safety plan is for that, et cetera. It doesn't mean those athletes don't get cleared. The whole point of it is to try to clear everyone, if you can, in a safe way. But it may just, don't be afraid if it takes more than that one visit to get them there. I'm giving you long answers. I hope that's okay.
Great. I love it. We're loving it. You're one of the first people that have stymied both Jason and I. That's a feat in and of itself.
I know. I'm just sitting back here listening. I'm like, all right.
Yeah, this is really, really, this is really interesting stuff. It really is. I mean, because you think about, you know, Down syndrome kids typically are heavier. You know, they gain weight because they're not active. Of course, their musculature is floppier, if you will. And so getting them active is really important, but obviously doing it safely is, you know, it is really the name of the game, if you will. So this is all real good information. I had a child came into my office and actually had an undiagnosed cerebral palsy event when he was born, had a interventricular hemorrhage and went undiagnosed for about 8 years. And he came in up on his tiptoe and his wrist was flexed. And I said, how long has he been like that? He's always been like that all his life. And I said, well, what was the cause? And they said, well, nobody could ever tell me what the cause was. And it was like, oh, well, let's go look. Have we ever done an MRI? And so we did get one. And of course, you could see the area that was affected and such. How would a physical therapist deal with that kind of injury with a child who's on the up on his tiptoe versus like a physical medicine rehab specialist? What would be the difference in those two?
That's a great question. Yeah. So we would work together. And that's one of the things that I love about the field of physical medicine and rehabilitation, and specifically pediatric rehab medicine, is it's so interdisciplinary. So what we're doing is going to be different, but it's going to really be complementary to each other. So, you know, the physical therapist is certainly going to be working on a good stretching program and strengthening program. And what we can help out with is there might be some bracing that we can look into. So we'll look at the way that the individual, sounds like this individual is walking. So we look at how they're walking and if any bracing might be helpful. Sometimes, especially if it wasn't treated for a while, we could think about serial casting, where you cast and then you come back, you stretch you know, as you can safely, and then you cast, and a couple of days later, you cut the cast off and you try to see if now it's been stretched for a few days, maybe you can stretch a little bit more and you cast again. And then, so that's one of the things that that we can do. And certainly sometimes you'll work with a casting clinic to do that, but you'll be, you know, kind of a bit of a quarterback of that type of methodology. And then also thinking about what type of brace. There's so many different braces that are out there that are really specific to the individual. So we're looking at where are their joints at rest? Are they pointed down that they're kind of stuck and contracted? Or are we able to get them to neutral? And where are they bending at their ankle, at their knee, at their hip? What muscles are strong? Which muscles are weak? Which muscles are spastic? And that's kind of how we make those types of decisions. And then there are oral medications and injections that we can consider too. So oral medications, baclofen is one of the big ones for a kid with cerebral palsy who has spasticity. And then Botox is a big injection that that can be considered, especially if it's really focal. So it sounds like in your example, like, you know, the calves might be a big target, whereas an oral medication is going to be affecting your whole body. So for those individuals that have really targeted areas. And then sometimes it does involve, you know, us referring off to a surgeon too, to think about orthopedic surgery or sometimes neurosurgery that can kind of help with some of those symptoms as well. When I think about, you know, you mentioned physical therapy, and when I think about sports and injuries and such, one of the things that I find interesting is, you know, when I ask about exercise, because we all should be asking about exercise in kids with and without disabilities, and we all know that, and that's guidelines. I think I've gotten the question a bunch of like, does physical therapy count as exercise? And I would make the argument no. So yeah, so I think that's one thing that I'm also cognizant of. It used to be back in, you know, years ago, it would be that kids with disabilities would be in physical therapy like every week for their whole life, right? And that is not a great strategy. And so we moved away from that because, gosh, we want them to live a life too, right? And family scheduling and all that. And so if you're in physical therapy all the time, you're not going to have time to do sports and other things. And so, you know, when I have the families come back to me and like, I know you prescribed physical therapy, but we did karate instead. I'm like, that's great. Like, this is wonderful, right? So they all have their place. Obviously, physical therapy is going to be working on specific goals, but now it's really in bursts. So it's going to be like, we are going to do this for 8 weeks and then you're going to implement your day-to-day life. And we want you to be doing your karate and doing your other sports too.
I want to switch gears a little bit from the injury side. And you brought up something before about like me talking about hydration and things like that. You know, teenagers in and of themselves are horrible at drinking water. But especially in some of the populations that you may be dealing with, where maybe they're nonverbal or they don't know how to what kind of guidance do you give to parents or to even coaches about like, these are signs that you need to either A, get out of the sun or go get some water. And also, while we're talking about it, what is your feeling on like the myriad of sports rehydration drinks? Are they necessary? Is water plenty?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think that there's certainly, as you guys know, probably even better than I do, there's certainly calculations out there that you can give and certainly have done that in different situations, especially in a clinic situation, if someone asks, what is the appropriate amount of water? Because obviously, much more rare, but we all know you can overdo it. And honestly, some kids with medical conditions like traumatic brain injury can actually overdo it for various reasons. So you know, certainly having that guidance, I think, is helpful. And now there's like tons of apps. There's actually apps now too, especially for somebody who like might not remember. There are apps that'll ping you to remind you to drink too. There's those water bottles out there now too, that kind of, I don't know if you guys have seen them, but it will sell you like time of day and they'll say like how much you should be drinking by different times a day by the lines. So that can certainly help. But yeah, I think a lot of it, honestly, you know, especially when you're dealing with either younger athletes with or without disabilities, you know, I think so much, I would say the coaches, and, you know, reminders from the clinicians can be really valuable of just like, you get so into the game, you get so excited. And so I think, you know, if you're lucky enough to have an athletic trainer, they're usually pretty good about staying on top of that for the athletes, but the coaches too, just like making sure that team is reminding people to stay out of the sun when it looks a little bit too warm, making sure to wear the sunscreen. So I think you're kind of relying on that team to make sure to have those reminders. In terms of sports drinks, I think there's a ton out there. I will be honest, I'm not necessarily like an expert on it. Typically, mm-hmm. for most kids, water is going to be enough. If you're going to be doing, you know, higher level events, marathons, like ultra marathons, all those things, which typically kids are not typically doing those. That's kind of when there's this whole sports nutrition area that has expertise in all of those additional supplements. So I think for many, straight up water is great. But I will piggyback on that and say that nutrition is actually something that's super important to be thinking about, because it's actually quite common for athletes who are teenagers, and I'm talking about general athletes, not necessarily the disability population, to be, you know, quite good at their sport and working really hard for so many hours, and then be maybe eating the number of calories that their peers are, right? And so we always talk about, if you're driving a cross-country trip, you have to fill the tank up more than if you're just driving around town. And it's the same concept for, you know, if you're a gymnast or a football player or a runner, you're doing like a lot of activity, you're going to need to kind of match your calories to that too. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I think if you have you have this athlete that you know is doing a lot of hours in your clinic, and you are fortunate enough to have access to a nutritionist, like these are some athletes that that's a good referral, is to get them in with a nutritionist. If you're fortunate enough to have a sports nutrition in your area, even better. And with telehealth nowadays, it's getting maybe a little easier to access too. If it's, you know, in state, but not necessarily your corner of the state, you can find some folks sometimes. And it's typically worth the investment, because what we know is for the athletes who are underfeeling intentionally or unintentionally, I think for years people just think of it, oh, eating disorder. It's often not an eating disorder. It's often just, no, but when does anyone teach you, right? That, you know, you're running cross country, you need to be really eating more. And what balance is that? We know that their risk of injury is much higher if they're not fueling, particularly stress fractures. And those are ones that are going to keep you out of sport maybe for your whole season, often the case. So I think more so than thinking electrolytes or not, I think probably the most important topic, I think, hydration, and just making sure you're getting the right nutrition, and, you know, maybe worth the investment, even if it's a one-time thing, to touch base with somebody who can kind of give you that guidance.
When you think about hydration, you know, there's a big push right now, this quote, pre-hydration. What's your thoughts on that?
I know nothing about it. Yeah, I kept that one off.
There you go. All
right. There you go. Honesty is the best policy right there, baby.
Yes.
That's right. But, well, I mean, it does. This is what I tell people all the time, especially in med school. You're not going to know it all.
And, no, even when you ask the electrolytes, I was like, I have read about that. It's not been the most recent reading, but I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Nowadays, I actually have a news program that I do here in Oklahoma. And we talked about that was our thing. It was dehydration and, you know, the best ways to approach the sports athlete. And they say, and they do say, they need to really, while they're not hot and sweaty and, you know, running 90 to nothing, they need to try to prehydrate and drink as much water as they can. And then, because once you get into the dehydration state, then it's very hard to try to pull yourself out in that, you know, in that time.
Totally makes sense. See you, the expert. There you go. Thank you.
but you are right. Nutrition is a better way to get not only the electrolytes that you need, but also calories that are needed than just drinking, you know, sugar drinks, especially like the sports drinks, because, you know, of course, we all know that sugar, you know, is a big, it's a huge molecule. So it actually can make dehydration worse.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, those, like, that's why the kids do like the pasta usually like the night before a big. So like those carbs that are going to stay in you a little bit longer are much more helpful than the sugary drinks.
Obviously, there's all these talks about this pre-workout supplement and this workout supplement and this post-workout supplement that's going to help you. Like, what is your guidance to, you know, an adolescent who comes to you is like, I want to start doing the, you know, I want to go out for football, I want to do this, or I want to become power lifter. So I saw this and I'm going to buy all of these.
Yeah, no, it's so big. I mean, that industry is huge and it's hard. No one can keep up with it, with how fast it's moving right now. And some of the information is more helpful than other of the information is. And so I think, you know, for me, I just, no matter what my patients come in to see me for, I usually say, like, better to come and ask, right? And then most of the time, I'm going to have to look it up, right? Like, I'm not going to know the answer that day in clinic. And then I'm happy to, like, look into it or look it up. But this is also where I think really partnering with a nutritionist who can help look into it or know the most current guidelines from the actual nutrition academic institutions is really valuable, because you want people to be safe, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that there's the industry is working what seems like faster than the evidence that really might be supporting it. And especially when you're dealing with, you know, growing individuals, you don't want to really take the risk on something that we just don't have enough evidence to know this way or that way. However, yes, you know, how much protein, how many carbs, like going back to those basics, that is probably going to be much more valuable than like this like magic pill that is being, you know, marketed online. So I would kind of go back to, you know, if you have the resources to like a nutritionist or sports nutritionist to see, you know, their thoughts on it. And then if there's someone that's super interested in that, then, you know, I would say that it would be well worth their time to talk to somebody like that who can actually give them specific guidance. Because there are things that are out there that are evidence-based, but there's a ton that isn't.
How much do you see as far as your area of medicine and you in, you know, you have a child who is developmentally delayed. You know, one of my focuses as a pediatrician was to push them as hard as I could until they, you know, couldn't go any further. But how do you see them in, as far as not just their physical condition, but their intellectual condition, their cognitive? How does that play into your area of physical medicine and rehab?
Yeah. So, I mean, I look at my, when I'm wearing my Pete's rehab hat, really like from the, you know, optimizing day-to-day life, I really think of it as, you know, a doctor function or like a, you know, quality of life doc. And so, you know, I really try, like the questions that you'd be asking any other kid about, what do you want to do when you grow up? And what do you do for exercise? Like really kind of leading those same questions too. Now, if somebody, because I've taught at medical schools too, like if you're not sure, if first of all, if you're not sure if someone's verbal or nonverbal and you're walking into the room, it is, or how they best communicate, it's always best to communicate with that individual first, even if you see that they're with someone else. There is a tendency, I think, to look to the other person sometimes. And that's something that I've heard. I've done some work with, you know, working with people with disabilities collaboratively on an education, that program that we did here at Harvard Medical School. And they kind of have told me, yeah, people are looking at the other person, but I'm perfectly capable of answering that question, right? And so so that's definitely something. And if then they're looking at you and they're not responding to you, give them a minute, right? Because they might, you know, there might be processing delays. There might be, they might be shy. Like there could be a million different reasons. Don't make an assumption. And then is appropriate, if you haven't heard anything after you've kind of paused, to turn to the person next to them and say, how does so-and-so best communicate? I've only once had someone offended by me doing that, in terms of them being like, oh, you don't know my child. My child doesn't communicate at all. And usually, though, they're going to more appreciate that. And when that person, you know, was offended, you know, I just, it was asking a little more. I was like, okay. I was like, you know, what about like when they're happy or they're sad, do they grimace? And then all of a sudden, they just lit up and were like, well, yeah, they'll show me this, they'll show me that. And I think it was just that trust of like, probably people get really used to healthcare providers not really knowing anything about disability, not being comfortable about disability. So being like, oh, you're just treating them like you don't even know. I'm like, no. I do know, but I want to make sure, you know, I understand the best. And people really do tend to appreciate that. Because sometimes it's like, all right, yeah, they're smiling. Is that okay? That's a good sign. We're happy, right? We're good. And so I try to approach it the same as I would with anybody else, but there's those little nuances that are there. In terms of getting involved in sports in particular, you know, I'll just assess the individual if it seems like getting involved in, you know, general mainstream sports would be appropriate. And when it is, you know, that's definitely something we'll talk about. And then there's adaptive sports. There's adaptive sports typically is referring to individuals with physical disabilities or blindness or low vision. There's also a deaf sports too, which is a little separate. The most elite version is Deaflympics. The most elite version of adaptive sports is Paralympics. And then obviously mainstream sports. And then there's Special Olympics, which is for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So depending on where they are on that spectrum, we'll talk about the different options. And I have a lot of kids, for instance, amputation is one of the main areas I focus on too. And so like a lot of those kids will be in mainstream sports. Maybe they'll do adaptive sports, but a lot of times they'll do mainstream. So that's something where they don't necessarily need to see somebody like me. They might be seeing their general pediatrician, but there's those of us that, you know, if a pediatrician needs to tap us in to be like, I don't know what the appropriate prosthetic to be prescribing is, you know, that we can kind of help out with that piece too.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And you actually answered the question I was going to ask, is when someone comes to you and says, which is the most appropriate field for me within within the spectrum, to make sure that I'm getting involved, but getting involved safely.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's interesting because for so many kids, they can be involved in mainstream sports and they prefer it. So I take care of a lot of kids who didn't have a disability, and then something happens, whether it's an accident or an illness, and that new normal of, wait, now I identify as somebody with a disability, is it's in a whole psychological adjustment, understandably, mm-hmm. right? And so I've definitely taken care of kids where I'm like, wow, you would be so appropriate for adaptive sports. You would love it. You would thrive, but they're not ready yet. Right. And so, you know, you just kind of have to meet people where they're at. And a lot of times they get there. Because I've been involved in this field, I've had the benefit and the good fortune of being friends with a number of people who've been Paralympic athletes, who've actually gone to the Paralympics. And, I've had, you know, I've been at conferences where people who do adaptive sports speak, and you hear time and time again that they did mainstream sports for a bit. And then once they finally got over the hump and went to an adaptive sport, they felt like they found their community, right? And so that's not going to be the experience for everybody, but that's why, you know, if someone's open to him, like, test the waters with both. Some people do mm-hmm. both. Some, you know, you don't have to. I have a friend who, she's okay with me sharing this story. She's shared it at a number of talks she's done too, but she was born missing part of her arm. So with a congenital limb deficiency, and she was on a mainstream swim team for a really long time. But she has some asymmetry, and the coach didn't really necessarily know, you know, how to best work with that. So that's something that, you know, she felt like when she got into the adaptive world, it, you know, people knew how to work with that a little bit more. But she has this story where she was at a competition and she got disqualified for not doing the two-hand touch. And she couldn't do the two-hand touch because she didn't have two hands. And so she actually worked on getting a policy approved. So now that's not the case in that state anymore. But you hear these wild stories where you're like, oh, my goodness. So, yeah. But she's a wonderful disability advocate and was able to get that better for people in the future for her. But, yeah, it's definitely there's an upswing and a downswing to each side of the adaptive versus mainstream for sure, mm-hmm. from a social perspective or just from a physical perspective. I did a research study with colleagues with six different institutions across the country, and we surveyed kids and young adults with lower extremity amputation or transverse limb deficiency, so it appears like an amputation, and about 30% of them said that one of the barriers to participating in sports was that their coaches didn't know how to work with them. So that's definitely like that's kind of like the corner of the world that I'm going to be working on is hopefully to get more information out there about what we do. First, we need to understand what we should be doing when I think about it. But if you want, I mean, we could also talk about just general, because I know probably most of what pediatricians are going to be seeing is kids in the general realm, too, mm-hmm. which I also take care of as well. So happy to answer anything on that. Yeah.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about the getting involved in sports. One of the biggest areas is the return to play after something has happened and how you coach families, and especially the stubborn teen that I'm like, no, it's not ready yet because of the risk of re-injury. What are some of your approaches that you have for having that conversation and assessing for the return to play?
Absolutely. That is when can I return is one of the toughest things I think in sports medicine, especially when, you know, you got the MRI back and it's a big one. It's an ACL injury or something of that sort. Like that one, in some ways, it's a straightforward conversation, but in other ways, it's a devastating conversation for that individual, right? It's not a brain injury. It's not something that, you know, might be considered medically more severe, but to that athlete, that's a big deal to be out of their sport for an extended period of time. And then you have these injuries that the athlete's like, okay, well, it's not an ACL tear, you know, like it's not a fracture, right? But you know that it's best for them to be, you know, doing a gradual return or doing some rest before a return. Really, it depends on the injury in terms of length of time, in terms of how long someone's going to be out. So definitely beyond the scope of the podcast. But how I approach that conversation, because the kids do not want to hear that, right? So my background is dance, and I'll say, so for me, I was fortunate not to have any major injuries, but I had mono when I was in college, and I guess they were worried from a splenic rupture perspective. They didn't let me, I did a couple different types of dance, but I was on the Notre Dame Irish step dancing team. And they did not let me dance, and I was supposed to be doing the halftime show at the Notre Dame UConn game, which was going to be televised. And so my wig danced, but I did not dance. So my wig danced on someone else without me. So I always actually bring that up because I'm like, I'm still mad at that doctor. You're allowed to be mad at me. Like, I get it. Like, I know, like, I don't know how much that helps, but I'm like, I you're allowed to be mad at me. Like, I totally get it. But then I explain, the reason I went into sports medicine is because I want people to do the things that they love. So I'm not going to take someone out of a sport unless I need to. And I feel like the reason I'm taking you out right now is because I don't want you to miss even longer of a time or have, you know, concerns later on in life that you can't still play soccer when you're in your 30s or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. because I know that if you take the time now and you do your rehab, you do your physical therapy, that we're going to get you back. And guess what? You're going to be basically working with a one-on-one coach, your physical therapist, for that whole time. You're going to come back stronger. You're going to come back and people are going to be like, who is this? You might even be better at your sport than you were when you left off. But if we put you back in too early, then you could re-injure and you might be losing maybe the whole season or the whole year. So I think when you frame it as like, listen, like I'm not just like some white coat that's sitting here that's like going to just dismiss you and be like, nope, you can't, sorry. I really want to let you know, like, I care about your sport because I know you care about your sport. And this is really actually going to be the best thing for you in your sport. So that strategy typically works. It's hard sometimes, especially with the longer injuries or the folks who are really elite and they're just like, gosh, I'm going to miss this big meet or this big competition. And at the end of the day, something I had to learn early in, you know, my being an attending was, sometimes people don't listen, right? And I mean, we all know that, right? And I think it was like the first time someone came back with a re-injury after going back before they were supposed to, I was like floored. And I'm like, oh, I guess I shouldn't have been that floored. Like, you know, this is not, you know, people will make their decisions, but, you know, I think us doing the best job that we can of explaining where it's coming from to folks.
Okay, hot topics now. So yeah. In pediatric sports medicine, the early super specialization versus, you know, having them play the different sports and they using their body differently to these kids that are like 7 and all of a sudden they're like, I'm going to be an elite baseball pitcher. What type of guidance do you provide parents? You know, they may have their eyes on, oh, my son's going to be or my daughter's going to be a professional athlete, but what they may be doing to that growing child by putting them in these super specialization categories.
Yeah. Very, very topical right now. I was sharing earlier, I am I'm in Boston for the summer at the Harvard School of Public Health working on my Master of Science in Epidemiology, and I'm in a systematic review meta-analysis class, and that is our topic. So I just actually met with a librarian about that exact topic right before this meeting. So yes, there was a study, and it was by Jayanthi et al. I can share the link, 2015, that I feel like is a really good read on the topic. That was the first real big study made NPR, from what I recall, and everything. It was a big deal. And it did show that early sports specialization was associated with increased risk of overuse injuries and serious overuse injuries. So not only injuries, but the ones that are going to keep you out for longer. So overuse injuries, meaning not acute, not a fracture that just happens from a freak accident, from a collision, but something that's happening because you're doing the same motion over and over and over again. So a stress fracture is on the severe side of that. The bone gets stressed over and over and over again until it has a crack. So we do see that in the literature. The current systematic review meta-analyses that are out there also demonstrate that the early sports specialization does have an increased risk of overuse injuries and serious overuse injuries. We'll see. It's been a few years since it's been done, so we're going to repeat it. We'll see what ours shows too. But I mean, I know that there's always that debate, right? Because like people always bring up gymnastics, right? So gymnastics is one of those where typically, aside from Simone Biles, who's showing us otherwise, right? Typically, the amount of time that you have in the sport is pretty short. So people do feel like they need to specialize early. So, you know, there was a summit in 2019 from the AMSSM, so one of the sports medicine organizations, where they got all the minds together thinking about this topic because it was such a hot topic. And really the consensus from there was we need studies from all these different sports, right? We need gymnastics specific studies. We need to be looking at this because we have some general data now. We need more studies that are looking, is this really the case for baseball too? You know, is this the case for, you know, looking at the individual sports? And we're not quite there yet where we have that level of guidance. What I would say is counsel and, you know, people are going to still make their decisions, right? Like life is about choices. And I always say that in my clinic too. And sometimes, you know, you have to make the choice that's right for you, even if there might be evidence that there might be a risk with it. Every choice we make in life has a risk. But the other thing is training hours, right? And so one of the other interesting pieces of that study that I feel like doesn't get quoted as much, but I quoted a lot in clinic, is that study found that you know, within reason, we're not talking about 84-year-olds. We're talking about like that pre-adolescent, adolescent age.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing more hours of sport per week than your age, that you had an increased risk of those serious overuse injuries. So that's something I will bring up as well, is when somebody's like, I'm doing gymnastics, that's all I want to do. But I'm doing 24 hours a week of gymnastics. That's another conversation that I'm having too. And it's like, well, I'm in the school gymnastics team, but it's not really that competitive and I don't like it as much. But the one that I do at the gym in my town is the one that I'm really interested in. And then, okay, maybe we make a decision and we're not doing both. But the idea with sport specialization, you know, I think comes along with cross training, right? Like, are you putting your body through the same motion over and over again, or are you adding some diversity? They've done some studies, and I'll be honest, I'm not as much of an expert in those, and I believe that those are still pretty young. So I don't think that there's like a huge body of literature on it, but they're starting to look at, does it actually increase your odds of being professional or elite if you're specialized? Because there's so many athletes that I can name that either started later in their sport or were actually quite diverse and then became elite in one level. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the verdict is quite out on that. But, you know, kids think that they need to specialize, but actually sport sampling may have a huge benefit to it if you can. And if you don't, for whatever reason, at least thinking about cross training to make sure that you're adding some variety in there.
Yeah. I would be interested to see if there's studies about if the early specialization leads to early burnout. If they just like are just like, I've been doing this too long, I'm done.
It does. That's another thing that's out in the literature too. That's another area of sport specialization that's been studied. And there is big concern that it's leading to burnout as well. So those are all things that, you know, we think about when we're counseling. But I think the training hours conversation, I feel like that comes up a lot in my clinic. And sometimes it's like these kids are doing like three different leagues and one of them they don't really care about. So it's like, all right, maybe cutting that is, you know, what we could be thinking about. And yeah, certainly I think is it the kid that's interested? Is it the fact that the coach says they have so much promise? Is it the fact that the parent sees that they're really good and they're adding pressure to it? Is it a little bit of all of the above? You know, I think that that's, you know, something to be keeping in mind too. Everyone wants to do the best for the kids. We all know that. And I think it's easy sometimes for adults to get a little carried away when we see, oh, that kid's doing really great. And, you know, trying to get them in. In the dance world, I see this a little bit with summer intensives. So summer intensives are great. It's like you do, you know, during the school year, you're dancing. And then over the summer, you might go to this really fancy place, you know, a more elite academy. And you spend a week or 2 weeks doing so many hours.
Mm-hmm.
But then we look at these dancers and, you know, they just were on the beach in summer for 6 weeks and now they're doing intensity. They're doing like 20 hours that week. They haven't danced in 6 weeks and they're used to doing 4 hours a week during the school year.
Yeah.
So we see a lot of injuries during those times too. And so that's another thing that I just kept, not necessarily don't do it, but, you know, if you're going to do it, listen to your body and realize like, listen, you're not in the Olympics. You're not on Broadway right now. If you need a break, take a break. You're a kid. That's okay. To try to take some of the pressure off of these kids.
Yeah, I think you brought up a great point because we talk about sports injuries, but we don't talk about maybe those who are in the band or those who are in like show choirs and, you know, dance competitions, the cheerleaders, they're getting tossed in the air.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up marching band too. I think there's a handful of studies and like stress fractures can definitely happen when you're doing that. Those are the same motion over and over and over again. But yeah, I've done a lot of work in like the performing arts medicine arena, and it's interesting because those like circus or figure skating or dance, you know, they are really like, you know, you can debate if it's a sport or not, but it's really on the same spectrum. And so making sure that those athletes are getting the same, you know, considerations too. I always mention those athletes usually don't need a pre-participation physical, which I think is kind of a bit of a loss, right? Because that's a huge benefit we know from the pediatric side is when these kids do sports, they have to come in for their pre-participation physical and they get screened and sometimes things get found, right? You know, those cardiac things that are getting found because of those physicals. You know, I would love to see a world where kids who are doing those other type of organized activities are getting those screens too. Yeah.
Yeah. We are coming up on the hour as I've been sitting here. The Shirley Ryan Ability Lab was something that was new to me. I hadn't heard of that before. And now I feel bad because I see you've been number one in rehab for 36 years. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about what you do and what the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab is as we close out the hour?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's such an honor to work at Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. I did residency there, and I just started back there in April with my physician scientist role. So it used to be called the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. And after a generous donation from the Ryan family, I changed names to the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab a number of years ago. And yeah, right as of right now, we actually got the message from the CEO today, because I'm not sure if the U.S. News and World Report kind of just came out again with this year's, but 36 years, it's the only institution in any category that has been the top hospital for 36 years in a row. So pretty amazing. And yeah, it is a freestanding rehabilitation hospital. It is affiliated with Northwestern. It is downtown Chicago. And pediatric through adult inpatient rehab. So after people have big, accidents, spinal cord injuries, amputation, traumatic brain injury, stroke, or, polytrauma, multiple fractures, or medical conditions that require a long stay in the ICU and they need some rehab. So folks who have maybe heart transplants or liver kidney transplants, et cetera. And so there's inpatient rehab. Inpatient rehab is where you get 15 hours of therapy a week during your stay, and then you're rounded on by a physician at least 5 days a week. At Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, seven days a week. And there's always somebody in-house. That's one of the things with inpatient rehab. So there's always somebody in-house. So it's distinct from, people think of like skilled nursing facilities. So that's a different type of rehab. That's a different level of care. So folks need to meet certain criteria in order to be in an inpatient rehab. But then Shirley Ryan Ability Lab also has outpatient clinics, so sports medicine clinics, as well as outpatient clinics for all the different disability diagnoses we take care of. And then they have something called Dave Rehab, which I love, which is intensive outpatient, where you might need those 15 hours or close to it of rehab, but you don't necessarily need to be hospitalized, but you do need some medical care too. So you'll get checked in by a doctor. Maybe you have once a month or twice a month check-ins with a doctor that's overseeing the plan, and then you get your intense rehab. So we are lucky to have people come from around the country, around the world, due to the resources there. One of the big things with when the new hospital came, it's a brand new, beautiful building. One of the big things is integration of research and clinical. So I'm really fortunate that I'm one of seven of the physician scientists that we have. But there's a huge research component too. So there's PhD labs. I'm fortunate to be in the Center for Bionic Medicine. So I'm working with some really, really brilliant engineers who are developing things like robotic prosthetics. And so I got to work alongside them as well, which is pretty incredible. So the whole concept was, how do we get what we're learning in research to the patients as soon as possible? And so that's a big model of the hospital.
Well, that's really neat. And I like the term ability lab. Mm-hmm. It's not rehab. It's we work with your abilities.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's working with to get people to their quality of life and working with the abilities that they do have and optimizing it. Because rehab gets that approach of it's getting you back to where you were before. It's kind of what rehab. So there's habilitation, rehabilitation, pre-rehabilitation. There's all those different terms. But I do agree with you. I think that they picked a good term there. And the work that they do is pretty phenomenal. Everyone there seems to just be really passionate about it.
Great. Well, I don't want to take more of your time, but I want to thank you, Dr. Jennifer Dubon, for coming and sharing your expertise with us. I think this has been a really excellent talk and something that I know a lot of our listeners will not have thought of. So thank you again for taking some time and enjoy getting your master's. One of these days you'll decide you don't want to be in class anymore. I would say the same thing of myself, but
we're We're all lifelong learners, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, this has been a great session. It really has. And we definitely want to get that link to that you'd mentioned earlier. We'll get it posted along with this podcast through the ACLP. And of course, it's just been wonderful. I've learned a lot. I wish I had the ability to use it more, but I'll be able to pass it on to my students at our medical college.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. We will be back in September with, I don't know, we'll figure out who our guest is going to be in September. But everyone enjoy what's left of your summer, and we'll see you back in the fall. The ACOP PEDScast podcast series is the official podcast of the American College of Osteopathic Pediatricians. Your hosts are Jason Jackson Dio and Scott Cyrus Dio. Original music by James Cyrus of Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any requests for topics or you'd like to be a guest on the PEDScast podcast series, please email us at PEDScast@acopeds.org.